The following was originally recorded for the national radio series Focus on the Family, featuring psychologist and best-selling author Dr. James Dobson. This cassette contains a three-day series from the Focus on the Family radio broadcast. The first 2 days of this series featured a taped presentation by the Assistant Police Chief of the Los Angeles Police Department, Mr. Bob Vernon. Let's begin as program co-host Mike Trout gets things underway.
We're going to present the testimony from a good friend of ours, a man who has been in the spotlight here in Los Angeles recently.
Mike, he has, and we'll explain that in a moment, but we're going to devote today, tomorrow, and the next day, 3 days, kind of a mini week, to our friend, Chief Robert Vernon, who is actually the Assistant Chief of Police of the Los Angeles Police Department. He's in charge of operations, all 18 police stations in that very large police force, one of the largest police departments in the United States. Report to Bob Vernon. He's been there, I think, 37 years and has done a wonderful job in that assignment. But Chief Vernon is under attack these days. The Los Angeles Times has been on his back for 2 or 3 years, not because he's made mistakes, not because he's done things they can point to, but because he is a believer, because he's a Christian. Specifically, they are criticizing him because of this commitment to Christ. And they go back and they get tapes where he's spoken and things that he's done at his church, and they try to make something significant out of it. Well, we feel that Bob Vernon is entitled to explain his own case. We feel that he's being abused and that his civil rights are being violated. So what we're going to do is air a two-part program of a speech that he gave. It's actually a tape that he gave several years ago called God's Direction in My Life. It's going to be very helpful to teenagers and those who are just coming through high school or college and they're trying to get their feet on the ground and they don't know where they're going and they're not sure how to find the will of the Lord. These 2 days are going to be very helpful for them, and I hope parents and loved ones will order tapes for their teenagers or young adults if they're in that situation. Mm. But then on the third day, we have invited Bob Vernon to be with us. So he's actually going to be here in the studio along with David Llewellyn, who's an attorney at the Western Center for Law and Religious Freedom. And we're going to talk about what is happening to Chief Vernon and what his First Amendment rights are, constitutional rights as an individual to believe anything you want. That is the one thing we're entitled to do. In this country, you can believe anything you want. Now, when it begins to affect how you act, then perhaps you violate the law. But in Bob's case, he's been criticized for what he believes. We don't think that's fair, and we're going to put the spotlight on him a little bit this week.
What he has believed for a long time.
Yeah.
And he has for a long time been a model officer in the Los Angeles Police Force, and yet some of this stuff is just being drug up in a very inappropriate way recently.
He didn't get to be the number two man in that department, being kind of schlocky.
That's right.
I'll tell you that. And he also believes what you and I believe and what we stand for here at Focus on the Family. I think you'll hear that on the tape that we're about to hear.
We see and hear a little bit of Bob Vernon every day here at Focus on the Family. Bob Jr. has been a part of our staff, a key member of the film department, and we're so pleased to have him as a part of the team. Let's go ahead and start the tape.
I came to know Jesus Christ as my personal Savior early in life, as a preteen, actually, just as I was beginning my teens, about 12 years old. And I was brought up in this real good church, Bible-teaching church, and I heard these messages, and I believed what I was hearing, and it seemed reasonable to me. And at 12 years old, I took the step. I took the leap of faith that many of you have just taken recently and became a Christian, you know, joined the family of God. And, of course, as I entered high school, I was kind of interested about doing what God wanted me to do. I'd read several verses. One of them was in Jeremiah 29th chapter, where it says, "I know the plans I have for you, saith the Lord, plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope." And I know some of you have read the Campus Crusade Four Spiritual Laws. And the first one, you remember, is God has a wonderful plan for your life. And you know, that kind of sounded good. I like that idea. God, the creator of the universe, has a plan for me. That's kind of neat. I'd like to know that plan. And so immediately after becoming a Christian, that was one of the first concerns I had. God, you got a plan for me, huh? That sounds kind of good. I'd like to know about it. Can you let me know what it is? And so I tried to find out. And, you know, I have to admit something to you. I kind of expected something miraculous to happen. I kind of expected, like in the middle of the night, you know, a weird angel standing at the foot of my bed, flapping his wings. You are to be a radio announcer, or, you know, something like that. Some weird thing. And it didn't happen. And I kind of expected that sometime maybe it wouldn't be quite that magnificent. Maybe I'd be sitting in church and all of a sudden, Africa, you know, and I'd see the spot on the missionary map in front of the church kind of light up, you know, or something like that. And, you know, that didn't happen either. And I'm not belittling God. I'm not saying He can't do miraculous things. He has in the past. And occasionally today He does miraculous things. Well, every day really He does them, but I mean that kind of miraculous, kind of dramatic type with an angel standing at the foot of your bed. You don't hear that too often today. Now, once again, I'm not saying He can't do it, but generally speaking, if you're expecting that, let me say this. I don't think that happens too often. We have God's revealed revelation to us right here. We don't need those miracles that they had to have years ago. We have His completed word right here, the Bible. And that's one of the reasons why I think it doesn't happen. Well, anyhow, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but I was kind of expecting the miraculous, and it wasn't happening. And I was getting into high school, and nothing was happening. No call, no special message, you know. And I started wanting to know what school I should go to. And I began praying and saying, God, you know, I want to know what you want me to do now. Can you just kind of clue me in on the college, you know, or maybe the major even. That would even help, if not the college. And suddenly, instead of miraculous, weird things happening, you know, angels and all that stuff, very common things began to happen. For instance, my mom said, hey, Bob, have you ever considered Biola? And after we had the conversation, I went back to my room and I thought, I wonder if God would choose my mother to lead me to His, you know. I mean, that's not too dramatic, you know. Well, I just kind of forgot that for a while. And my sis came home from college. She was going to Biola. She said, hey, Bob, you're going to consider Biola, aren't you? Hey, all in the same week this happened. And then the thing that really topped it off, a buddy of mine, that we're graduating from high school together, he said, I know the transportation is a problem. He said, I just bought this motorcycle, and I know you're thinking about transportation, about college, and you don't have enough money to live in a dorm, and you need to stay at home, you need to go to a local school. Well, I just bought this motorcycle, and I'm going to Biola, and I'd just love to come by your house and pick you up. I thought, you know, my mom, my sis, now my best buddy. You know, you mean God leads through those undramatic ways? Well, you know, things started happening that way, and several other things happened to interest me in Biola. And it was nothing flashy or anything, but I just thought, well, I'll kind of start moving in that direction, see what happens. And so I started moving in that direction. I made application. I was accepted. A few months later, I found myself attending Biola. And I thought, well, at least I think that this is God's will now, you know. And I went there for 2.5 years. Then something happened. Oh, Uncle Sam was knocking on my door. I was 1A, you know, and everybody was being drafted, and I was called down for my medical, and they said, be ready to leave in about 30 days. And so I thought, wow, you know, here I go, Lord. Gee, I don't want to go in as a regular infantryman. I'd like to do something that later on I could parlay into doing something on the mission field. Maybe I can have them teach me how to fly airplanes. I've always loved to fly. And so I made application for the Air Force in their cadet screening program, not as an enlisted man, but to go in as a pilot. And so I went through a series of tests here locally, and I passed a test, and they sent me up to Parks Air Base, and I started going through the tests, and there were 33 of us from the western states, and the first test was the stanine test, and I got through that, and the next day was a psychomotor test, got through that. Each day about half the guys were washed out. The next day was a medical exam all day, got through that, and there were only 3 of us left. They said, now there's only one more test left. I said, what's that? And they said, the psychiatric. Well, that's no problem, you know, the psychiatric, I'm normal. I went in and I sat down, and the guy who was the psychiatrist, there were 3 of them on the base. I selected one just, I thought, by chance. Later on I found out it wasn't so much by chance. I went in and I sat down, and he said, oh, I have your history here, Mr. Vernon. See, you went to Biola Bible College? I said, yes, sir. He said, you religious? I said, well, yeah, I guess you'd call it that. I term it a little different than you, but yeah, that's pretty accurate. He said, well, if you're religious, what is your religion? I said, well, I'm a Christian. Oh, you're a Christian. Who do you think Jesus Christ was? I said, well, I think he's the Son of God. I believe that. He said, do you really believe that? I said, I really do. He said, in other words, you believe in a personal God. I said, yes, sir, I do. And you, let me hear that again. You believe that Jesus Christ was his son. I said, that's right. He looked at me. He said, let me see your fingernails. Hell on my fingernails, you know. I'm not kidding. And he said, oh, you don't bite your fingernails. I said, no, I don't bite my fingernails. He said, did you stutter when you were a boy? I said, no, I didn't stutter when I was a boy. He said, well, there's definitely an emotional instability here to be so religious as to believe in a personal God and that Jesus Christ is Son of God. He said, you're hyper-religious. And he said, I'm afraid we're going to have to fail you in this portion of the exam. And, you know, I thought it was some kind of put-on. I thought it was some kind of a deal to make me react. And so I just sat there with my arms folded and kind of smiled at him. He said, well, you can leave. You're free to go now. I said, well, you mean that's all? He said, yeah, I just told you I'm eliminating you from the competition. You know, I got up and I still thought it was some gag, you know, and I walked toward the door and I expected him to say, okay, let's get down to the real interview. You know, and I walked toward the door and I paused and I looked over my shoulder. The guy still hadn't said anything. I opened the door and I kind of stalled going to the door, you know. Nothing happened. And I found myself really eliminated. So I went over to the head of the selection team at Parks Air Base and I said, say, something really strange happened. The man in charge said that he was a colonel. His adjutant had questioned me first of all, and as soon as I started talking, the colonel got up from his desk and he came out and he said, you had trouble with one of the psychiatrists about religion. And I said, yes, sir. He said, that was probably Lieutenant so-and-so, and he named the psychiatrist. And I said, yeah, how did you know? He said, well, you see, we're having a little problem with him. And he said, I want to make something very plain. That is not the position of the United States Air Force, and you have a protestable item. He said, you can write to Washington, be examined by a panel of three psychiatrists. And he said, I'm sure everything will be all right if that's the only matter it was. But he said, the guy has a hang-up on anyone who is religious. And as I was coming back in the airplane, you know, I just kind of thinking things over and kind of praying a little bit, you know, and all of a sudden, kind of like a light went on. You know, like you see in the comics, light goes on. And I thought, you know, I've been praying for God to lead me and let me know what he wants me to do. And that's kind of a coincidence that I just happened to pick this guy out of all the men up there. And maybe this isn't just a coincidence. Maybe this is kind of the way God leads through circumstances like that. And I began to realize something. God doesn't lead too much today anymore with angels, but he leads through things like that. And all of a sudden I felt very much at peace about saying, I guess the Air Force isn't for me. And I came back to Los Angeles and fully intending to be drafted any moment, and I didn't get my notice, and I was kind of in between. I didn't know what to do. And I thought, well, I'll start pursuing my next great love. But my first great love was to be a pilot. I had it all planned. You know, I'd go let the military train me. I'd come back. I'd join Missionary Aviation or JARS, you know, that part of Wycliffe Translators, and fly the jungle planes and all that, real romantic. And I thought that'd be great. And that, you know, God said, no, don't want you to do that, at least not through the Air Force. And so my next great love in life was to be a policeman. My father had been a policeman. I knew a lot about police work. I really liked it. But I'll have to be honest with you. I really never thought, just like most of you, I never thought that the two were compatible, being a committed Christian and being a cop. And so I kind of brushed it off to the side. But when I came back from the Air Force trip and had nothing to do for a few months, I was kind of puzzled. I didn't know what else to do, and so I thought, well, I'll move toward the police department, see what happens. So I started going through the exams, and when they started giving me the exam, they they presented a motion picture on there. I forget the title of it. It was called The 25th Man. And the title came from the fact that the LAPD only takes 4 out of every 100 men that apply. And I thought, well, God, there's a good chance to flunk me out. You know, the odds are on your side. So I started taking the test, and I took the, once again, the written test, and I got past that. And I went and took an oral examination. I got past that. Took a physical agility. Got past that. Took a medical. Got past that. They said, now there's only one more test left. Can you believe it? The police department also gives a psychiatric exam. This was a real exam. The other was a 3-minute interview. This was a real exam, looking at the ink blots and all that kind of stuff, you know, and filling out a personality scale, and later on coming back a few weeks later and sitting down and having an interview with Dr. Rankin. And I'll never forget Dr. Rankin looking at that written exam, and I don't know how it showed up, but he said, Mr. Vernon, you didn't want to take this portion of the exam. I said, that's right. He said, why? I said, I'd rather not discuss it, sir. Respectfully? He said, well, we'll have to flunk you in this portion of the exam. I said, I'd really rather talk about it. And I told him what happened at Parks Air Base. And when I told him what happened, he said, you mean you believe in a personal God? I said, yes, sir. He said, would you go over that again about who you think Jesus Christ is? And I'll have to be really honest with you. Just for a few seconds, a thought entered my mind. Vernon, you need a job, man. You better water this one down a little bit. You better tell him that you think that Jesus Christ was a great teacher that had good principles, was a great leader of men. You better let it go at that. You know, I almost said that. And then the other thought that came in my mind was, wait a minute. If God doesn't want me here, I don't want to be here. And if God wants me here, no psychiatrist is going to keep me out. Be honest. So I said, sir, I believe. And I thought, you know, I really thought I was going to get flunked out again. So I thought, I'm going to go out in a blaze of glory, you know. So I said, I believe that Jesus Christ is a son of God, and I carried a step further. I said, he's alive today, and I know him personally. Talk with him. He looked at me. He said, do you really believe that? I said, yes, sir, I really do. He said, you know, that's great to see a young man who knows what he believes. Stick by his guns. He said, we're very happy to have you in the Los Angeles Police Department. I said, you mean? He said, well, you know, I'm not going to say that I agree with everything you've said. But he said, you know, that psychiatrist, I don't know what he was thinking about. He said, but we're finding out the facts that we're getting from Korea. And this at that time was right at the time the Korean conflict was winding down. He said, we're finding out from Korea that men who have a profound faith in God are more emotionally stable and able to endure more stress than someone who has faith in nothing. He said, the first men that the communists separate from the rest of the group when they start their brainwashing is anybody they see praying or that somehow manifests a faith in God. They say, well, you know, get that guy away. We don't want him to pollute the rest of the guys. And so he said, you see, we feel that this is a very good trait. Even though we don't agree with all your doctrine, perhaps, we just like to have you aboard. And so I found myself entering the academy and a few months later graduating. Well, you know, I had some doubts. I found myself walking a beat on East 5th Street between San Pedro and Central Avenue. That was tough in the 50s. And loving it. Now, I really enjoyed it. I still enjoy police work. But I felt a little guilty. Do you mean that when you're in God's will, it can be fun? You know, somehow I thought that God's will was all sacrifice and you really didn't like what you were doing, but you were giving something to God, and God would always put you somewhere that you didn't want to be. In fact, I heard some people get up and say that. You know, the last place I wanted to go was Africa. And where did I find myself? In Africa, you know, and the guy. And, you know, I heard that before. And I kind of expected, certainly God won't place me where I want to be. And so I felt guilty. I thought, I must be out of God's will. Even though I've been praying and all, I must be out of God's will. And so I began praying, God, let me know, am I really supposed to be here? Man, I love it, God. I'm sorry, but I like it, but I'm really supposed to be here. And just like God spoke to me, you know, I didn't hear a voice or anything like that, nothing dramatic. But things began to happen. I have a story I like to tell teenagers because it's kind of funny. But it, I think, illustrates what began to happen during those early few years, literally every day. Weird things. I was always at the right place at the right time. And police work, that's really important. You know, you like to be driving by the bank when the bandits come running out. You know, that's that's really neat if you're a cop. Or driving down an alley when a guy comes out the window, a burglar, you know, and that's really kind of neat. Well, let me just tell you this one story. I'm going down Avenue 43 right there in Highland Park area. Not Avenue 43, come down North Figueroa Street, approaching Avenue 43. And right at Avenue 44, there's a 76 Union gas station. And I came driving down, and guy out in front of the gas station is jumping up and down, great big eyes, and he's pointing over toward Avenue 43. So I figured something must have happened, you know. So I kind of looked over toward Avenue 43. And sure enough, there's another guy. He's pointing down toward the Pasadena Freeway. So I turn left to Avenue 43, and I'm going down Avenue 43, and about two blocks later, I get to the freeway, and right alongside the freeway is Carlotta Boulevard. There's a little side street there that runs parallel to the freeway, and there's another guy pointing down Carlotta Boulevard. Now, by this time, I'm curious, you know. So I pull a right on Carlotta, and there I see what had happened. You know, there's one guy chasing another guy, and the guy in front has got both hands filled full of money. You can see the bill sticking out. The guy's running. And right behind him is a guy with a 76 Union gas station uniform on. Now, us cops, we're pretty smart, you know. We figure out what's going on. So I jumped out of the car and I started chasing the guys, you know, and now there's three of us running. The only problem is they had run about 4.5 blocks or so, and they were kind of tired, you know. And so I caught up with them quite rapidly, and I passed the guy with the uniform. I figured he was all right. And just as I get next to this other guy, I notice that he's got a weapon tucked in his belt, and he turns around, he sees me, he reaches for the weapon, and legally, I could have shot him, really, but rather than shoot him, I was close enough, I just whipped out this little thing we call a sap. It's a little leather thing that has lead in the end, and it really slows people down, you know. And I just wrapped him on the head with that, you know, and he just fell asleep real quick. And he's laying there, and the money's going all over the street, you know, and the guy from the gas station, he's collecting the money, and I took the weapon from the guy, you know, and I threw it in the front seat of the police car, and I put the handcuffs on this guy, and he's starting to come around now, and I drag him over to the police car, and I open up the back door of the police car, and just as I open up, my radio, 11075, 11075, that's me. 44 till tap of the service station just occurred, Avenue 43 in Figueroa. The suspect was wearing black trousers. Black trousers. Red sweater. Red sweater. He was last seen running toward the Pasadena Freeway. You know, I reached over and I picked up the microphone. She's still broadcasting. He took $85 in miscellaneous. I broke right in. 11L75. Suspect in custody. She couldn't believe it, you know. She said, 11L75, repeat. So I repeated it, you know, and finally she believed me. And so they canceled the all units broadcast, and I drove back to the service station. And the first guy that was pointing, you know, first guy in the civvies, turns out he's the owner or leasee or whatever you call him of the service station. And he said, he was walking around throwing his hands in the air. He said, it's fantastic. It's amazing. I said, what's that, sir? He said, this modern police department, scientific advances. He said, I just hung up the phone and there you were. Well, honestly, during those first few years, as a rookie on the street, things like that began happening Literally every day, I'd come home and my wife would say, all right, sit down. So, what happened today? And I'd had some hair-raising tale to tell. And, I got a lot of attention from my supervisors because of this. And, I'm not patting myself on the back. God always just had me be there. And one of the guys used to call me the name of the guy in Little Abner comic strip where a cloud follows him around and everything's happening all around him, you know? Joel Splink or something like that. And he used to call me that. And then a couple of the other guys started kidding me. They said, you sure you're not in on some of this? You know, you always just happen to be there, you know? Well, God was good. And God answered that question I had. Lord, you really want me here? And I knew that it was outside of my control. Something was happening outside my own capabilities and abilities to figure things out. And so I said, oh, okay, I get the message, Lord. I am supposed to be here. Okay, I get that. Thanks for that. Now, why do you want a committed Christian in this slot of being a cop? That was my next prayer. And almost as soon as I began uttering that prayer, that was 2 or 3 years after I got on the police department, I began getting answers to that prayer. I began getting opportunities to share with various groups, agencies, schools that normally would not ask a preacher or pastor to come into their group and give them a talk. For instance, PTA groups. They'd say, now we understand that you know quite a bit about juvenile narcotics. We'd like for you to come and speak to our PTA group. And my normal answer, it still is, I still get requests like this. I say, well, fine, I'll be glad to give a talk. I want you to know that when I do these on my own time, though, that I have to let you know that I go a little deeper than you may want me to go. And they say, what do you mean by that? Well, a lot of these problems, like narcotics problem, that's a surface problem. You have to get down to some very root basic problems. Basically, there's some moral issues involved. And if you're going to talk about morality and morals, you have to have a foundation for those morals. And I think that the Bible happens to be an excellent foundation. If you don't mind me quoting from the Bible and talking about some moral issues and some spiritual truths in the Bible, I'll be glad to come. And you know, for some reason, they're not afraid of cop, you know. They say, well, you're a policeman. No, that's all right. You can come tell us anything you want. Just give us the answer, you know, whatever the answer is. And so I found that God began answering my question of why. Let me just give you a couple recent opportunities that I've had because of my position. I was asked to come back to Chicago just a few weeks ago. We went back to Chicago, and people on the North Shore of Chicago, which is kind of like the Bel Air, Brentwood, Beverly Hills area out here, they had organized a group of executives for a couples club dinner. And it was held at the very fashionable Winnetka Women's Club in Winnetka, right near the Percy Mansion. And so we went there, and just before I got up to speak, this guy who organized it came up and he said, Bob, he said, I thought I'd just tell you this. I've never seen as many millionaires and presidents of corporations gathered under one roof in my life. He says, there's 250 men out there, and most of them are millionaires. I said, thanks a lot. You know, I just came up to speak. But I was privileged to be able to speak to these men as a deputy chief from the Los Angeles Police Department, and of course I was invited to speak to them about social issues of today, about pornography, about narcotics, about many issues that are on their minds today that concern them, and they're looking for answers and they want answers. And of course, I addressed those problems. I talked very specifically about some of those problems and gave them some very, what I think are practical answers. But I also gave them my reasons for those practical answers. And I concluded by telling them my personal relationship with God and telling them that I think the basic answer to all of these issues are found in a proper relationship with God and following His commands and His way of living. And that night, 50 of those top presidents and vice presidents of corporations came forward and registered a first-time commitment to Jesus Christ. And I say to God, why me, Lord? Well, let me conclude by giving you the three-point verse message that led me along the way and that makes my life worth living and that makes life an exciting adventure for me every day. And it's found in Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. And you'll notice, as you look in that verse, that there are three prerequisites and then a promise. And the three prerequisites go like this. Number one, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Okay, let's talk about that for just a minute. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. That's the first prerequisite to being placed in a position of being guided by God. You see, the promise is, and he shall direct your paths. You see that at the end of the verse, of verse 4? But the first prerequisite is, number one, trust in the Lord with all your heart. I imagine most of you sitting here tonight think, well, you know, at least I've got that one going for me. But let's talk about that for a minute. You know, that's more than simple intellectual assent or simple belief. And I think that the reason a lot of people today do not feel the presence of God in their life, do not really know him personally, even though they believe in him, is that they haven't taken that belief to the point of commitment. They haven't trusted in the Lord with all their heart. Most Americans believe in God. You get in conversation with the average American. I was talking with one of my colleagues at work just Friday. And he was a little bit depressed about life after death. He said, I don't believe there's any. And I said, well, do you believe in God? Well, of course, I believe in God. And he sincerely believes in God. But he told me, he said, but I wish I had the faith that you have. He said, I don't have it. I said, well, you could. It's just a matter of your will, of taking that step of faith. And he said, well, I can't for some reason yet. He said, my wife wants me to, but not yet. For some reason, I can't. And so there is a difference between belief and trust. I remember the situation where we had to raid the Panther headquarters at 41st and Central. And we organized a group of men. And we knew that we had to get six men to take with them what we call the key to the city. The key to the city is a battering ram, about that long, and about that big around, made out of solid lead. Can you imagine how heavy it is? That's why we need six men to carry it. It's that big around, that long. It has three handles on each side. The reason we call it the key to the city is that it opens any door. And so we had to get six men to take that battering ram, and we felt certain we would have to use a battering ram, and have them, if in case we did have to force entry. We knew that the front door had sandbags behind it with automatic weapons, and we had warrants of arrest commanding us to go there. The Superior Court commanding Los Angeles Police Department to serve these warrants. And so we went with a group of men. Six men took this battering ram and were standing by in case they needed it. And of course, we very legally let them know we were there. We said, police officers, we have warrants for your arrest, open in the name of the law and all that kind of good stuff, you know. I did it all legal and proper, and we were met, instead of an open door, a pipe bomb came out of the second story window and exploded right alongside the officer with a bullhorn that was giving the command. He picked up a little shrapnel and moved to one side. Then we brought up the men with the battering ram. Now, these men knew that there was an automatic weapon on the other side of that front door. They knew that. But they had put on bulletproof vests under their coveralls. They were what we call a SWAT team. They had these bulletproof vests. Now, I've seen those bulletproof vests demonstrated at our academy. I believe them. I believe in them. But these men trusted them. And you see, there's a big difference. You can stand and very impersonally watch someone fire a gun at that bulletproof shield against the embankment at the academy, against the sandbankment right there, and you can see the bullet ricochet off. You can go up and examine it and say, no, it didn't penetrate. Hey, that's great. And you can believe. But to really trust one of those, you'd have to do something like these six men did. They put them on, and they went through a door that they knew had an automatic weapon on the other side. They knew they would take some gunfire. Now, that is trust. That's also a lot of courage. And these six men took the battering ram. They hit the door. The door went down. And sure enough, you can see it in the photos we took, an automatic weapon opened up on them. And the first two guys took a burst of gunfire. They had on the bulletproof vest, so they didn't get hit in a vital area, but it knocked their legs out from under them. The other men went to the side and tried to pull him out of the way, and as they were pulling them out of the way, a third officer was hit with a burst of gunfire. Three officers wounded. One officer had a piece of bone about 3 inches literally knocked out of his leg by the automatic machine gun. We had to retire him because he never was right after that. But you see, these officers demonstrated their faith in this life-saving device, the bulletproof shield. Now, I imagine that most of you, if I had it up here on the platform, would believe it if I demonstrate it and say, look, see, it deflects a bullet. You believe? Yeah, I believe. How many would like to put it on and let me shoot at you? You see, there's a difference. There's a difference. And it's that way with God. A vast majority of Americans believe in God. Thinking people believe in God. I was talking with Ken Poor, a friend of mine. He said, I just had a conversation with the guy. He says, I don't believe in God. And Ken says, great. The guy looked at him kind of surprised. And he was standing, Ken is kind of a car nut. In fact, he used to be a used car salesman. And he was standing next to this Dodge Charger. And he says, by the way, you see that Charger? And the guy said, yeah. Ken said, guess where it came from? And the guy said, I don't know. And he said, it just oozed up out of the pavement. And the guy said, come on. And he said, what do you mean, come on? And the guy says, well, you know, everybody knows that comes from Detroit. And Ken said, right on. Everybody knows that a car demands one thing, that there somewhere is a car maker. And people in the world, in the universe, tells us one thing. Somewhere there's a people maker and a world maker and a universe maker. And he said, that's why I said congratulations when you said I don't believe in God. Because he said, you know what? You have a lot more faith than I do. Think of that for a minute. To have faith that everything came from nothing and that intelligence came from non-intelligent matter, that takes a lot of faith. So the big question is, do you have faith or not? The question is, who do you have faith in? So most people believe in God, but how many have taken it to the point of commitment? Second prerequisite. Number two, lean not unto your own understanding. Don't depend on yourself to figure things out for your life. You know, I was going to figure it all out. God, I'll go into the Air Force. I'll let them train me. I'll become a jungle pilot. You know, I'll do all these things. And God, I've got it all planned. That you just kind of endorse it, if you will, and I'll carry on with my business. And God said, that's not what I got planned. You know, I'm glad that he let me know what he wanted me to do. Because now that I know more about myself, now that I've lived with myself a few years more, I know that I'm in the job that I really enjoy the most. Commit your way to the Lord and he'll give you the desires of your heart, the Word of God says. Lean not unto your own understanding. I was working with a partner that we worked the felony car together for several years. And we rolled on an emergency call one afternoon where a woman had been very viciously beaten and robbed and raped. She needed ambulance care immediately. And as we pulled up, another radio car pulled up, and we were in a plainclothes car. But it was one of those kind where everybody knows who you are, you know, with the aerials and all that. And so as we pulled up, the other officers pulled up and they said, look, we'll get her to the hospital. Why don't you guys take off? The guy went that way around the corner. We said, all right. So we took off down the street. It's another one of those deals where people are pointing and all that, you know. So it ended up about three blocks away in a motel. And we went up to the motel owner and identified myself. And I said, we're looking for a guy that fits this description. I had it all written out. She said, well, we have two. We have one over number two and one over number 38. That both of them fit that description. I said, well, okay, thank you very much. So I went back, told my partner. He said, well, let's hit two first. I said, all right. So we went to the front door. And I looked in the front door, and we were going to deploy around the house where my partner went in the back door. But before we could get that far, the front door was open, and he saw us. And he was standing in the kitchenette portion of the motel, and we could see everything but his hands. And he was the guy. So before he could get a chance to get his gun or anything, I just unbuttoned my coat, and I pulled my gun from my shoulder holster, and I pulled out my badge in this hand, and I stepped into the living room, and I said, police officer, freeze. And usually, when you do that with a .357 Magnum, you know, usually they just freeze. But this guy, instead of freezing, you got to get the picture now. He's standing in the doorway and couldn't see his hands. And as soon as I said, police officers, freeze, he just moved after something. And all I could see was his foot. And then I could see his weight shifting back, and I knew he was coming back. And, of course, you figured out probably the same thing I did. He got his gun. He's coming back after me. And so I went into a crouch position, combat position, and I began to put pressure on the trigger. I was going to fire as soon as he came around the side of the door. My partner, in the meanwhile, had slipped in behind me, and he could see more of the guy than I could. He had a better angle. And he saw me with my gun out, and of course he had his gun out too, but I heard him yell just as I began to put pressure on the trigger. Bob, hold it! And right in that fraction of a second, I had a decision to make. Follow my own intellect, follow everything that I knew was right through my training and everything. I knew this guy was armed. I knew he was after his gun. He's coming back. He's going to shoot me, and my partner's telling me not to shoot. Well, thank God I didn't shoot. Because, you see, this wasn't even the man. He was up in Department 38. We later arrested him, by the way, so don't worry, ladies. He's all taken care of. But this man was not the man. He fit the description. But he was standing in his kitchenette peeling a potato. And when a strange man with a gun stepped into his room, pointed a gun at him, it kind of frightened him. And that potato, ladies, you know how it is sometimes, the starch substance kind of gets all over it when you're peeling it. And he kind of flinched, and it shot out of his hand like a bar of soap. You know? And he went after that potato as a reflex. Because, you see, later I asked him, I said, why in the world did you make a quick, what we call in police jargon, a furtive movement after that potato when you knew I told you to freeze? He said, officer, I didn't even think. He said, man, that potato went. He said, my body went after it. Before I even thought about it. Well, the principle there is, and what I'm trying to illustrate, and what I think the Word of God is saying here, is God is in a position to see more of the situation than we can. He says, lean not into your own understanding. Trust Him. Everything may look reasonable to you to take some action. But if He says no through his Word, and of course to know His guidance, in order to lean on His understanding, you're going to have to know this Word. And you got a good break coming to this church. You'll know this Word. The more you know this Word, the more you get to know God, the more you'll know what His guidance really is. And listen carefully now. Watch this. Once in a while, in fact, quite often, you'll find that your own rationale and this guidance from this Word will conflict. It'll be different. Just like my intellect and Nick's telling me to hold it, there was a conflict there. He's telling me not to shoot. Everything I know tells me to shoot. But the rationale here is, lean not at your own understanding. God can see more of the situation than you can. He's in a better position. He's a creator of the universe. It may not make sense at the time, but you'll thank God later on. I like that. And finally, and the last prerequisite, in all your ways, acknowledge Him. And of course, that's the opposite of ignoring Him. You come to Him and you bring Him in on the plan. You tell Him when you've got a decision. You let Him in on it. You say, now, Lord, I don't know what school I'm going to go to, and I really need Your guidance. You bring Him in on it. You know, sometime I have to utter very quick prayers in law enforcement. I was down at USC at the beginning of the summer session here several years ago. I was a young sergeant, and they have a tradition. But the first real hot day, they wet everybody, and they wet one another on Frat Road, on 28th Street, right there. And this was several years ago, and I got a radio call to meet one of my units, one of the radio car officers, and they were there. They said, oh, something terrible's going on. I said, what's that? And they said, well, you know, the kids wet each other every year. And I said, yeah. Well, this year, they're not only wetting one another, but they're wetting anybody that drives down that street. And this just happens to be a lady that was going to the USC clinic there, and she's pregnant, and they threw this 5-gallon can of water right in the window. It got all over. Her husband swerved, being frightened, had a slight collision with the car. They had to rush her to a hospital. She's giving birth right now. We hope that the baby's okay. But, you know, this has got to stop. This is causing problems. I said, oh, boy, we got to stop it. I knew there were hundreds of kids out there. And so I called every unit that was clear. I think there were about 7 units clear. I had them all meet me there. We're around the corner. And I took one officer with me, the biggest, baddest officer I could find. And I think, I said, you're going to watch over me, and you're going to get on that radio if I need help, okay? And he said, yes, sir. So we got in the car together, and I said, the rest of you guys, when we ask for you, you come around fast. But I began praying. Not out loud. I didn't want everybody to think I was a nut, you know, but just right there in my mind, I just started saying, God, you know I'm going to need wisdom on this one. And, you know, lay it on me, Lord. I need it. And just as I was rounding the corner, a plan came into my mind. Well, the first part of the plan was don't go in there with a big armed force of guys with helmets and nightsticks and all that, you know. Probably have a big confrontation. So I took one officer. That was part of the plan. I rounded the corner, and as I was rounding the corner, the second part of the plan came into view. Look, these guys are having fun, right? Right? Why not make it kind of funny? Don't come on too serious. Come on humorous. So I rounded the corner, and you could hear all these cat calls, and woo, here comes the pigs and the fuzz and all that. So I got out, and they all came up, and they had all this water, and they're ready to wet me. And I said, okay, I know, it's my turn to get wet. But before I get wet, I'd like to talk to, take me to your leader. I come in peace. You know, I yell at my hand. Being funny, instead of saying, all right, you guys, you know. So I said, you know, take me to your leader. So they did. They walked me over to a guy, and they got a guy, and they put him up with a towel around his head like a turban, you know. And they said, this is our leader. And so I walked up, and he said, what would you like to say? I'd like to say a few words before you pronounce sentence upon me. And man, they really thought that was funny. And so I said, I had to shout. I didn't have a microphone. I said, you know that this street is your street. And a big cheer went up. You know, there are about 300 of them out there. Big cheer went up. And I said, the Los Angeles Police Department knows this is your street. And a bigger cheer went up. No. I said, but these poor citizens don't know it isn't your street. Boo, you know, big boo. And then I said, seriously, gentlemen, and I went into the story of what happened with a lady who was pregnant coming to the clinic. And suddenly everything became very quiet. And I said, you've had some fun, but you've just caused a problem. And I'm going to ask you to go back into your houses and stop the fun. And I got off the platform and I walked back to the car expecting any moment a big blast of water to hit me. But you know, it never did. I got back in the car and I still expected something to happen. I was afraid to look back. We drove off and I looked in the rearview mirror. And as I looked in the rearview mirror, all I could see were people going back in the fraternity houses. And I said, thanks, Lord. It's a good plan. You see, he says, in all your ways, acknowledge him. Take that moment to bring him in on the plan and say, Lord, I need your help. You know, the Lord loves to hear people say help, to admit that they need him. He loves that. And the promises. Now here's the whole real message tonight. If you don't get anything, get this. If you fulfill these three prerequisites, he doesn't promise to reveal his detailed plan for your life to you. But he does promise you one thing. It says, and he shall direct your path. He doesn't say, I'll let you know what it is. I'll let you know what you're going to be doing 5 years from now, or I'll let you know what I want you to be. He doesn't say that. He just says, I'll direct you. In other words, get this now. This was revolutionary to me when I first grasped a hold of this thought. If you do these first three things, trust in the Lord with all your heart, lean unto your understanding. In other words, follow his rules. In all your ways, acknowledge him. Bring him in on a plan. It says, in effect, what it says is, you won't be able to be out of his will. Don't expect a note from heaven with a brick, you know. Don't expect an angel in the middle of the night. What he says here, if you do these three things, you will be in my will, whatever you do. You won't be able to get out of it. In short, God will literally guide your path. The creator of the universe. And that's exciting. People today, as psychologists, as business leaders, as governmental leaders across this nation are saying, people are living harder and enjoying it less. Deep depression is afflicting more today than ever before. The sale of tranquilizers continues to go up. And you want to know something? One of the reasons is that they don't have any purpose. Any real reason for being here on planet Earth. And I was talking to a young man just this last week who reached the zenith of his wildest dreams. And he says, now that I'm here, I'm depressed. I said, you're depressed? He said, yeah, where else is there to go? I've reached it. He said, it's all downhill from here. He said, it's just getting old and dying, man, and there's nothing after death. The guy was depressed. Let me tell you something. When you can feel and sense and know that you literally are doing what the very creator of this universe wants you to do, you don't get depressed. It's exciting. When you're in God's will, there's just really nothing like it. Oh, you have problems. Certainly. Nowhere in the Bible does it say when you join God's forever family, all the problems cease. But he gets you through the problems victoriously. I'm going to ask you to bow your heads as we conclude tonight. I feel compelled to offer an opportunity for anyone who has really never taken their belief to the point of commitment to join the family tonight. And I'm going to do it a little differently tonight. You know, you don't have to sign anything to join his family. You don't have to go through any ecclesiastical exercise of any type. You can take that initial step of faith, that first prerequisite, trusting in the Lord with all your heart. You can take it right where you sit. You can take that great leap of faith right in the privacy of your own heart. And I'm going to ask that all over this auditorium, those that are here tonight that are in a position of perhaps always believing in God, or at least having a sneaking suspicion he's there, but never taking that to the point of commitment, we're going to give you that opportunity tonight to take this first step toward really recognizing and realizing God's will and great plan for your life. And all it takes, on the authority of God's word, is for you to invite him into your life. The Bible says in John 1:12, but as many as received him, speaking of Jesus Christ, to them gave he power to become the sons of God. You don't have to join this church. You don't have to go through anything else, really, except what the Bible says. But as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. For by grace are ye saved, through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God. It's a step of faith. Another verse. But God commended his love toward us, in that while we were yet sinners, Jesus Christ died for us. And so all it takes is that step that I took, and I remember the day, I remember the moment, I remember kneeling in the basement of a church and saying to God these three things, and this is what I encourage you to say right where you sit. Number one, God, I admit that I'm a sinner. You know, that wasn't too hard for me. I knew I was a sinner, and I think you do too. Secondly, I believe that Jesus Christ, your Son, died for me. And thirdly, right now, I receive him into my life.
Well, with that, we are at the end of a two-day series entitled God's Direction in My Life, a personal testimony from Bob Vernon. And listening to those final words from Bob reminded me that we receive some letters here at Focus on the Family every once in a while, maybe more than I would suspect that we might get, saying that because of a broadcast that we've aired, someone has dropped to their knees and has accepted the Lord. And there is absolutely nothing more thrilling than to read a letter like that.
Yes, and in terms of finding your way in life, Mike, that is the beginning point, because unless you have that gospel, unless you have the good news, then it really doesn't matter how much money you make or what kind of work you do or what you wind up accomplishing in life. That is the first priority. So it's a good place to end that discussion. I enjoyed that tape, didn't you?
I sure did. Bob has been a popular speaker for a long time. I've heard him at some youth camps. And to hear his testimony, that's the first time I've heard that. And it was neat.
I'd like to just add one thought that occurred to me as I was listening today, that you know, what makes it so difficult for a young person to get started in life? And I think I've made reference to this before on the broadcast, but you have to get a lot of things together simultaneously. You have to bring, as I see it, at least six components to bear on that decision. In order to really enjoy and feel productive in a life's work, there are six things that you have to coalesce, and here they are. First of all, it has to be something that you like to do. I mean, who wants to spend a lifetime doing something you don't like, even if you're successful at it and earn a good living at it? Secondly, you have to find something that you can earn a living doing. I mean, you may like to be an artist or a poet or a prospector or a historian or something that nobody wants to pay for. And so you are constantly at odds with yourself and your family because you can't earn a living, even though you like it. Third, it has to be something that you're permitted to do. You might make a great doctor, but they won't let you into the medical school. You know, so the profession has to admit you. You have to be allowed in. Fourthly, it has to be something you're capable of doing. You might really enjoy being a doctor or a lawyer, but you really can't cut it. You don't have the academic skills to make it. So it has to be something you're able to do as well as something you're permitted to do. Those are two separate things. Fifth, it has to be something that you get some emotional satisfaction back from. In other words, society or somebody should say, this is important what you're doing. I think of Van Gogh, who spent his life in paintings that people didn't appreciate. And we know now that it was pretty high quality stuff. One of his pictures of a sunflower sold for, what, 25 million, I believe? Or it was 25 million pounds.
Some
I was in
incredible
England
amount
at the
of
time.
Money, yes.
But there are those five things. Then sixth, you have to find something that God seems to approve of, something he puts his personal endorsement on. If you're a Christian, that becomes the most important, as we said. Now, the interesting thing about those six, Mike, is that any one that's missing will blow it. I mean, it's not enough to have five of the six. You can have everything, all five of those things together, or so it seems, and not be able to earn a living at it, and it's not enough. Or you don't like it, and it's not enough. Or you're not permitted to do it, and it's not enough. Or you feel like a failure doing it, and it's not enough. You've got to get all six of those together. Now, when you think about it, trying to do that when you're 18, 19, 20, 21, or even 25 or 30 years of age is tough to do. I mean, I'm not sure that I would be mature enough right now to make that decision for myself over if I were starting now and were not going to choose the profession that I eventually chose. You know, where would you start? That's a tough question. You got to know yourself. You have to know the opportunities. You have to know something about what real life is going to be like in that profession. And I think that's why many young people sputter and stumble their way through young adulthood. And their parents look at them and they say, what's wrong with you? You've dropped out of college. You don't know where you're going. Why don't you get your life together? And sometimes it's kind of difficult to get all that together. And that's why this tape is so important. That's why it is so meaningful, because you begin on your knees before the Lord saying, lead me, Lord. I am trusting in you. Be a lamp unto my feet. Mm. And that's a pretty good place to start.
You know, there was one other ingredient that I heard from a good friend of both of ours, Jerry White, some time back. He said, a daily conversation with the one who is in charge of it all makes all the difference.
The one with all the answers.
Yes,
right?
The one with all the answers, a daily devotional life. And I know Bob Vernon has a strong daily devotional life. And Bob is going to be our guest tomorrow.
I'm excited about that, Mike. We've had him here on tape these last 2 days, but he's going to be here alive and in person, in living color, tomorrow. And there's a reason why we've invited him here and why we've kind of made this Bob Vernon week here for this 3-day period at least. Bob's going through a lot of pressure, as we've mentioned. I think I mentioned it yesterday. The Los Angeles Times, some members of the city council here in Los Angeles, even some of his own colleagues in the Los Angeles Police Department are on his case primarily because of what he believes. Not what he's done, but what he believes. And obviously what he believes is what we've heard today.
That's right.
He's a strong, committed Christian, and he's being persecuted for that. And I think Bob's entitled to tell his story, because he sure hasn't had many opportunities to do that here in Southern California. So I'm really looking forward to having Chief Bob Vernon here in the studio.
And that's how the first 2 days of this 3-day series came to a close. On the third day, Dr. Dobson invited Mr. Bob Vernon to the Focus on the Family studios to discuss recent articles that have appeared in the Los Angeles Times and the Los Angeles Magazine. Once again, let's join Dr. Dobson, along with program co-host Mike Trout, as they provide a further introduction.
Well, Mike, we're here to talk today about a subject that is has really been the topic of some concern, and I'll admit it, some irritation to me personally, because we've been watching in the last few weeks here in Southern California, really in the last year or more, but specifically more recently, a highly competent and dedicated public servant. I'm referring to Chief Bob Vernon of the Los Angeles Police Department. We watched him being smeared by some members of the L.A. Times, not all of them. Some have been very fair, but some writers for the L.A. Times, by some of the city councilmen and by some of his colleagues in the Los Angeles Police Department, primarily because of what he believes. Not what he's done, mm-hmm. but what he mm-hmm. believes. And what he believes is what we believe mm-hmm. in terms of his Christian faith and Christian beliefs. And we just can't sit aside here and watch that occur, watch someone being attacked, not for breaking any law or even any policy in the department, but simply because he is a Christian with conservative Christian views. And that's why we have asked him to be here, along with another guest I'll introduce in a moment. Chief Vernon, my friend Bob, welcome to Focus on the Family.
Doctor, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
We have respected you for years. We've aired some of your presentations and tapes. You and I have had a friendship that goes back 20 years or so, I guess.
Many years.
Also with us today is an attorney who specializes in First Amendment rights. He's also been a guest on Focus on the Family in the past. I'm speaking of David Llewellyn, who regularly defends religious and civil liberties cases or people who've had those rights violated. He is president of the Western Center for Law and Religious Freedom and has kind of become a consultant to Focus on the Family on some of those issues. Those issues are at stake here, aren't they, David? I mean, that seems to be what we're talking about.
They are very definitely at stake. The as I mentioned to you earlier, the issue here is older than the First Amendment. This is the issue of religious tests for public office, and the kind of attack that Chief Vernon has been subjected to is really an attack that says, we want to have a certain set of moral or spiritual values in public office, and if you don't fit this new morality that we've composed here, we don't think you should be a police chief any longer. And they're, in effect, imposing a religious test for public office.
And the Constitution absolutely prohibits that.
Absolutely prohibits it.
And if you get past that one, you got to deal with the First Amendment.
The First Amendment then enforces that against all the states and every local official as well, yes.
Now, Bob, some of this criticism began when the Los Angeles Times Magazine, I guess, reviewed a tape of a speech that you gave at your church many years ago, even in the 70s, I believe, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. That was the Los Angeles Magazine, not the Los Angeles Times.
Yes. I'm sorry.
Los Angeles Magazine reviewed some tapes that were made many years ago, and then they, in my opinion, perverted what I had said, really, and paraphrased and used statements out of context and made it sound like I belonged to some, in my opinion, religious cult or something that was way off the mainstream. When really the principles they talked about are very mainstream biblical principles of disciplining children, of police officers being ministers of God. I don't know why that bothered him. By the way, that quote was pretty accurate. They just said
yeah.
that, but for some reason that bothered him that I felt that way, and that
Ephesians 5, I believe,
the
masculine
wives,
leadership in the home.
Yes, wives should submit to husbands, and husbands should, in a similar way. Be servants to their wives. They didn't quote that part, of course.
You belong to Grace Community Church, John MacArthur's church. You're a member of his board of directors, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, we call it the Board of Elders, and yes, yeah. I've been there for nearly 15 years and a member of the board for about 10.
John, of course, is on the radio all across the nation. There are 10,000 members there. It's hardly some kind of little cult or some kind of weird religious sect or what have you. And yet, the things that you said were highly offensive to somebody. What was the major text of this article? What was it that they were saying about you?
Well, first of all, they went over those issues that I've just related, and then they said, and this person is standing in the wings and is perhaps the heir apparent should Daryl Gates be moved out. In fact, the headline of the article was The Dan Quayle Principle Strikes Again. Mm-hmm. And they basically are saying, this man could possibly be the next chief of police, and we surely don't want that to happen with these weird beliefs. That's what they were saying.
A lot of people have been hearing about Chief Gates because of the Rodney King incident that occurred, several months ago here in Los Angeles.
March.
I think that was national news. I'm not sure the situation you've been involved in has made the national news. It may have, but it certainly has been all over the headlines here in Los Angeles.
Bob, you made reference just a minute ago to the Insider, I guess it is, Los Angeles Magazine. This is the article we were talking about. The headline says, "The Dan Quayle Principle Strikes Again. Liberals eager to give Police Chief Daryl Gates the heave-ho may want first to check out who's in line to fill his standard issues." It goes on to name the things that we were talking about before, but at the end there's this statement. Vernon also cites biblical scholarship to tell parents that if a child is rebellious, you must break them. If it takes beatings, you give them beatings, end quote. Now, I think you and I have similar views on corporal punishment, and I believe there's a place for it, and you do too. But I happen to know this was taken out of context. Explain what you really said on that tape, because this will reveal the motives of the writer.
Well, first of all, I do not believe in beating children. It's not only illegal, it's immoral. There's a difference between loving discipline and beating, and I do not support beating at all. I'm against it. What I was doing is I was relating a story where a father had promised his son a fishing trip, and the night before, the church called him, asked him to come down and work at the church at a work day. Without consulting his son, before his son woke up, he just went down to the church. The son was crushed, and because of that rejection, began acting in a rebellious way. And my whole point was that fathers should not provoke their children to wrath. But I said, how did the father react when he saw the rebellious acts of his son? He reacted, if you got a rebel, you got to break him. If it takes beating him, you beat him. And I was role-playing with my voice, the father. And then I paused and said, now who was wrong here? The father was wrong. The son wasn't wrong. Well, they took that, my voice, using those words, and have taken that quote out and attributed that as me encouraging that, or at least endorsing it.
And that was actually on Channel 11 News here.
That's right.
Implying that you were actually recommending that.
That's right.
Instead of the context.
Yeah, if you listen to the tape, you'll clearly hear me say the father was wrong.
I want to ask our listeners to put yourself in those shoes, to be in a highly visible position and have somebody take you out of context and deliberately try to smear you in that way. It takes a big man to stand there and take that. That's like getting hit with a 2x4 until they're hitting the knots from previous whacks of the 2x4. Have you attempted to explain that, or have you just taken it?
Well, I have attempted on a number of shows, and also talking with some newspaper people. And there's been a couple of writers who have pointed out that the statements were made out of context. And to them, I'm eternally grateful. But most of them have just disregarded it and said, well, that's very interesting.
Well, and once it's said, once it's put out there on television or in print, 50% of the people will never see the retraction or another statement.
Unfortunately, I have people from my own church who've approached me and said, I really don't think you should use the word beat, Chief, in encouraging people to discipline their children. And they think I said it. They think that I believe in that, and that hurts me.
In fact, Bob, I think a year ago I saw a highly critical article in the Los Angeles Times about you. So this is not just a recent phenomenon. Somebody's kind of been on your case for a good while, have they not?
At least 3 years. Yes, this is not the first time. And the last time, the Times had a basic thesis that somehow I was behind promoting only Christians to positions of authority. And, of course, anyone who knows anything about Los Angeles city government knows that the Civil Service Commission and the Personnel Department of the city is in charge of promotions, and I'm not involved in that process.
Now, you're the number two man in the department, and yet you do not have that responsibility for hiring and firing primarily.
There are two assistant chiefs of police, and the other assistant chief of police is over everything other than operations. I'm over all police work, per se, the 18 stations. He is over all of the so-called support functions, including personnel and training. So I'm not over the hiring and the promotional system.
Now, this is not primarily a controversy that has arisen out of charges against you within the department. I mean, you're doing fine there. This is outside pressure saying, this man holds to certain beliefs, therefore he ought to be investigated. And that's the issue that concerns me, because if they can pick you off that way, what other Christian in whatever public service position is secure? How would representatives of other views react to that? Can you imagine saying, this man is Jewish, therefore he should be investigated? Or this man is Muslim, therefore he should be investigated? Or this man is gay, therefore he should be investigated? That's not even likely anymore. It might have been 10 years ago. Only a Christian could be subjected to that kind of scrutiny. Am I correct in that?
You've hit it precisely on the head, Doctor. That's exactly what they're saying. They're saying, since this man has what we believe, I think they call them strange beliefs, therefore, since he has this great power of being the number two man, we should investigate to see if somehow these beliefs he has are being inappropriately utilized in his job. They haven't come up with allegations about my job, as you've said. They haven't said he's done this or he has failed to do this. They're saying he believes this. Therefore, there's a danger that this might somehow be involved inappropriately in his work, so we better look into it. We better cause an investigation.
David, is it not implicit on the critics to come up with wrongdoing first and investigate on the basis of that, rather than on one's private beliefs? And if you can't say what you believe at church, where can you say it?
Well, it reminds us of the witch hunts. It's Christians who are attacked for having hunted witches or attacked people because they believe things which are odd, and then convicted them without ever any evidence that they actually did anything. And that is what has happened, really, to Chief Vernon here. There's only one absolute constitutional freedom, and that is the freedom to believe. And there is nothing that can be done about that. There's the freedom to think, the freedom to believe, and the freedom to express what you believe. And those freedoms cannot be touched. It's when belief becomes conduct that the public has any interest in what someone does constitutionally. And then, of course, if any of these allegations, which have now come out of ages, anonymous allegations from ages past, which if they had any real value legally, would have been pursued, and there would have been police commission issues on these case fact situations long ago. But they never had any real value, and they've just come up now as scare tactics and scarecrow kinds of arguments.
Mike, do you remember a song from about 30 years ago called Standing on the Corner Watching All the Girls Go By?
I think I remember my parents listening to that.
Yeah, your parents. One of the lines says, brother, you can't go to jail for what you're thinking. You know,
yes,
remember that?
Remember that, sure.
That's based on the constitutional right to think what you want. It may be immoral, but you can't go to jail for it, and you can't lose your job for it, apparently. Is that correct?
That's true. Actually, at one time, there was a great concern that public officials, particularly Christians, you may remember in the election of John F. Kennedy, they were concerned about whether he might use his religious discipline, to affect his work. And there was actually a case, the Supreme Court decided a case in 1978 over a Tennessee constitutional provision that said that if you were a minister, you couldn't be a member of the legislature and you couldn't be a member of the state constitutional convention because they were afraid that you would hear from God or you would hear from your pastors or your board of elders, and that would influence how you did your job. And the Supreme Court said, that's totally unconstitutional. You can't put restraints like that on what a person believes and disqualifying them for public office.
So why is Chief Vernon having to go through this? I mean, if it's that clear constitutionally, how can they do an investigation when there have been no charges? Is this a violation of his First Amendment rights?
I think there's no question that it's a violation. Investigations ought to be rejected if there are no factual grounds for them. And the kinds of investigations, the kinds of calls reported in the paper are by people who clearly say, we don't want a person with this belief system having any influence on our police system.
One of the things that they're beginning to talk about now, and one of the stories that came out of this, was that I admitted consulting my elders on an issue that's dividing the nation and even is controversial in Christian circles regarding abortion. And I did. I plead guilty to that. I got moral, ethical, spiritual counseling from my board of elders. And I take that as a badge of honor. I wish some police officers in Selma, Alabama had got some moral, ethical, spiritual counseling prior to enforcing a bad law to keep blacks on the back of the bus or keep them out of institutions of higher learning. I think that's a great thing to do to get counsel. Of course, the question came up, well, what if your spiritual, moral, ethical counseling causes you to be in conflict with the city policy? And my answer is very clear. First of all, you would have to assume that I would agree with that counsel. And if I did agree with it, then I would go to whoever the authority is above me. At this point, it would be Daryl Gates. But if I were chief, it would be the commissioner, whoever. And I would say, you know, I morally, spiritually, I cannot fulfill this order you've given me. I think it's an immoral, unethical law. In that case, if I couldn't convince them of the immorality of it, and if they said, well, you haven't convinced us, you've told us immoral, we don't think it is, and we're giving you a direct order to do it, I would resign. I would retire. And then I would tell the world why I'm retiring. I'd say I'm retiring because they give me an order to fulfill what I thought was an immoral law, and I just couldn't do it.
The question is why that applies only to you, Bob. I mean, no one is neutral on values and moral precepts, and we all get them from someplace. So why is yours only open to scrutiny? Now, it is the policy, as I understand it, from the city council, Los Angeles City Council, that the Los Angeles Police Department will welcome homosexual officers and that there will be no discrimination against them in hiring, firing, and in the way they do their jobs. That's city council policy.
That's correct.
Now, they're bringing values of their own. I don't agree with them, but bringing a lifestyle and values the Bible speaks of, things that we believe are wrong, with them. They're not neutral when they come in. Is anybody asking them if they are willing to implement policies that might differ from those values? In other words, are they put through the same screen that you were when you were asked that question?
That's a very good question, and I don't believe they are. In fact, if you would attempt to do that, that would be cause for some kind of complaint against you and discipline against
you. You're harassing them because they're homosexual.
That's
correct. And yet we can harass you because you're Christian. There's something wrong with that, folks. Ooh,
I'll tell you what's wrong. We're in the era of this phrase, you've heard it a lot, of being politically correct. And I'm not politically correct, according to the power structure apparently in Los Angeles right now. I'm not on board with all of their thinking. And so I'm fair game.
Why, Bob? Is it fear that you are the heir apparent, or one of the heirs apparent to Chief Gates, especially now that he's going through some political troubles of his own?
I think there are probably many, two or three at least, motivations. I think that's one of them. I think that they feel we have to get rid of Gates, but we also have to get rid of Vernon because also have some integrity on certain issues like Daryl Gates.
It is political, isn't it?
Oh, very much.
The effort to remove Daryl Gates has a very strong political side to it, and the effort to remove you would have a political side as well.
Very much. They've done the same thing to Daryl Gates, and even more so than they've done to me. They've taken quotes out of context. They've attributed quotes to him that he never made. It's been a terrible thing. The man does not deserve what they're doing to him. He's an honorable man. He's a man of integrity. He's been a good leader for the LAPD, and it is political.
There is one city councilman in particular that I keep reading about, Zev Yaroslavsky. He is really involved in this pressure on you, isn't he?
He's kind of taken the point against me, and once again, I'm not going to be presumptuous and try to get into his head and figure out why, but clearly he is the one that's leading the charge.
David, now let's broaden this thing, because as much as we love Bob Vernon, we didn't do this program today just because of him. The larger issue is this witch hunt notion, this germ of an idea that Christians can be excluded from public office simply because of what they believe. That's a scary concept in its widest context, isn't it?
Yes, and it unfortunately has occurred much more broadly than just in police departments. It occurs on a regular basis in public education, where teachers are intimidated out of ordinary academic freedom, out of even teaching factual basis for moral or religious beliefs, or adequately teaching religion in the public schools, because they're concerned that if they teach it even in a normal, straightforward fashion, in an historical fashion, they will be accused of promoting their own spiritual religious values at the expense of others, even though those values are widely shared in our culture and in our history and are appropriate in the public schools. And they face this kind of intimidation on a lower level, but on a regular daily basis. And one of my concerns is that if Chief Vernon is subjected to this kind of intimidation and political pressure, and if it is permitted, if the Christian community and others interested in fairness in public life allow this kind of pressure to have any impact on the LAPD, that it will be a very bad signal and a very bad sign and standard for all others who are standing in other positions of public life.
Now, you have made it your profession at this stage of your life to defend people caught in that kind of unfair pressure. You've had a pretty remarkable record in the courts, haven't you? If people can gain access to competent legal counsel, they can win this thing. The law still defends the right to believe what you want.
Absolutely. The law is really on Chief Vernon's side and on the side of the public officials who are doing their using their best judgment in a conscientious and good faith manner in public schools and in correctional institutions and in child welfare organizations and other places where values, moral values, spiritual values, and religious values come into synergy. They have to stand up there. And the law protects them, but very often they're not aware of the legal protections. And what Bob Vernon did, incidentally, in taking this issue to his board of elders is what the Nuremberg trials said after the Second World War, people, particularly in the police and those who are authorized by society to use force, must ask themselves the higher moral questions. They must not simply assume that every order is a lawful order and therefore they should obey it. They should ask the question. Whether you agree with the conclusion he and his elders reached is irrelevant. He did the proper thing that we want people in public life to do, to raise these higher moral questions.
Almost every senior Nazi official at the Nuremberg trials charged with high crimes pled the same defense, that they were only following orders. They were only doing what they were told. And the verdict in nearly every instance was guilty. That was not an excuse. We are held responsible for our moral perspectives, aren't we? And even in a context where the whole society goes crazy.
Even to a point of, in the Nazis' case, punishment, imprisonment, even death penalties. And I personally would think that if we had high public officials who did not consider the moral consequences, if President Bush doesn't consider the moral consequences of a Gulf War, if Bob Vernon doesn't consider the moral consequences of Operation Rescue and the manner in which Operation Rescue people are arrested, an issue about which we've disagreed, and the Western Center for Law and Religious Freedom brought a lawsuit against the LAPD for the use of the Nunchucks device in arresting Operation Rescue people and succeeded in that lawsuit. But the resolution of that is not at issue. It's the process by which moral issues are properly brought to the fore by public officials, for which Bob Vernon is unjustly accused, in my judgment.
All right. The question again regarding the larger issue is, are we seeing the early stages of a national or international, speaking of the Western world, international trend toward persecution of Christians in high public office?
I believe so, and I believe it's even broader than that. I believe it's not only Christians that should be worried about this. I think it's people of other faiths also. I think it's broader than just Christianity. Anyone who opposes the so-called political correct position of whoever's in power is in danger. So this shouldn't be just restricted to Christians, although, of course, myself being a Christian, I'm concerned about that impact.
Yeah, if you take a Christian out for what he believes, who's next?
Right.
So it's all of us, really, that you either have freedom or you don't.
Anyone who believes in constraint, as the police must constrain evil, and therefore they operate in constraint. If you want to teach sex education and teach constraint and abstinence and moral values, if you want to teach discipline in the public schools, anyone who has a constraint orientation toward self-discipline and public morality is subject to severe attack. It's an anything goes, no restraints. It seems to be the rising tide of public morality.
Bob, let's spend the last couple of minutes talking about you personally. How are you standing up against this pressure? I'm not sure in this 30-minute program if we have adequately described what you're going through. I mean, this is not just an article in Los Angeles Magazine. I mean, you are under siege.
Well, you've been on the radio and television every day or almost every day in the newspapers regularly.
And there is a call for an investigation of you that we've alluded to and so on. How are you and your family holding up?
Well, remarkably well. Believe it or not, they actually staked out on me between the church parking lot and the sanctuary yesterday, and two television reporters with their cameras were there and caught me on the way into the church worship service. That's the extent to which it's gone. There have been many people praying for us, and all I can explain, the only way I can explain, rather, the peace and the inner joy that I have is because of that prayer, because I should be falling apart. My family should be falling apart. There have been a couple times when we have been pretty discouraged. I've come home very many times to have my wife greet me in tears and my children concerned and having problem with sleeping and things like that, various members of the family. So it has been a drain because it's my reputation that's being destroyed.
37 years with the police department.
37 years, and not only is from the human point of view my future ending here with the LAPD, but I don't think there's another city that would touch me either. I've had dreams of maybe at some point retiring from here and being the chief of a smaller city somewhere. But I think that's all over too, you know, from the human point of view. They've destroyed me. They've made me look like a fool.
But if God be for us, who can be against us?
Amen. I believe that.
I have just seen some miraculous things that happen when God fights our battles for us. And I'm going to ask our people to pray for you. And if the LA Times and the city council doesn't like that, that's really just too bad. We're going to hold your names before the Lord, and I believe he's going to bring you through this thing. Whatever happens, I want you to know we're standing with you, my friend.
That means a lot. And God's people have prayed, and we have definitely felt those prayers, and we're doing fine.
Bob, have you felt the support of the men and women that you've worked with over the years, or have they been silent? Are they waiting to see what's going to happen and then make a move?
You know, it's amazing how many people that I'm sure are not Christians because of the language they've used when they've come up to me and told me to hang in there and a few expletives deleted. Don't let those get you down. We're with you, Chief. We're supporting you. And so it's been really comforting to see the vast majority of the men and women of the department really supporting me.
There was a rally for you at the Parker Center police headquarters a few days ago. Radio station KKLA sponsored that here in Los Angeles. Were you there?
Yes.
Give me your response to what happened there.
Well, that was fun. There were several hundred people there, and it was the middle of the week and in the middle of the day, and it's very difficult to get any crowd out. And there were several hundred, 400 or 500 people, and that was encouraging to see the makeup of the crowd. I mean, it was the full spectrum of folks from the Los Angeles area, of all ethnicities and social standing, and there was even a biker club there that was there to support me.
If somebody out there wanted to write and express an opinion on this subject, to whom would they address it?
Probably the Los Angeles City Council, just the president of Los Angeles City Council, John Ferraro.
And what's that address?
That would just be City Hall, Los Angeles, 90012.
Maybe we can send a note or two to them to let them know how we feel. Thank you for being here, Bob. Hang in there. Again, our prayers are with you. David, I appreciate so much the work you're doing. You're a sucker for an underdog, and I like that. That's kind of what drives me.
There's at least two of them in this room.
I can't resist somebody that's getting beat up unfairly. I mean, I'm in the fray right there.
I think the Lord led the way on that one.
He did. So we'll stay in touch, and please do keep us informed of the progress in this area.
We sure will. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, we come to the end of this Focus on the Family cassette. If you enjoyed this cassette and would like to find out what other tapes we have available, you can write to us and ask for your complimentary copy of our cassette listing. Here's our address. It's Focus on the Family, Pomona, California, 91799. And thank you for listening.